Phillips v. Rohrbaugh et al., Kimberly Murphy, Lisa Campo, Appellant's Counsel, Robert Scully, John Bolin, Ian McElhaney, Appellee's Counsel. Chief Justice, it looks like we have everyone present.
All right, let me explain real quickly to the lawyers. When the appellees have two counsel, but they're arguing for separate parties. Consequently, the clock will be 15 minutes for Mr. Scully and 5 minutes for Mr. Bolin. But when you reach your 15 minutes, Mr. Scully, the time is up. All right, Ms. Murphy, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Murphy, and I, along with Lisa Campo, represent the appellant, Susan Phillips, in this matter. We're before you this morning based on a dismissal of Ms. Phillips' complaint based on a demurs that were filed by both the co-executors of the estate of John M. Rohrbaugh as well as Mark Rohrbaugh individually. I'm going to turn the justices' attention to the first set of errors that were identified by Ms. Phillips in her briefs, dealing with the interpretation of Virginia's adopted Power of Attorney Act. Specifically, the lower court, the circuit court, ruled that you must read sections 1612 in harmony with 1614A and 1614B. And we submit that that is an incorrect interpretation of the law. Beginning with 64.2, 1612, you can actually divide that statute into two core sections. Subsections A and B are essentially the duties that an agent must adhere to, and they go through and list and enumerate several different duties. However, beginning with subsection C of 1612, that gets into liability and the liability of agents. When we go to sections H and I, these are mandatory or disclosure provisions of 1612. 1612H is adopted almost verbatim from the Uniform Power of Attorney Act that was promulgated and recommended by NCUSL, the National Commissioner of Uniform State Laws, and adopted by the General Assembly, except with some minor revisions to it. Within H is a mandatory disclosure by an agent to a guardian, conservator, an executor, or another fiduciary acting on behalf of the principal. That is a mandatory disclosure, meaning the agent must disclose information to that appointed fiduciary. I, however, is a holdover, carryover from Virginia's existing and prior law, which allowed for certain limited disclosure by an agent, which was a carryover from Virginia Code Section 11-9.6. That section has been eliminated since adoption of this particular section of the code. What I does is allow a discrete group of people to make a demand upon an agent for disclosure of actions taken by that agent. But there are conditions set forth in 1612I. Those conditions are whether or not there's a good faith basis that the principal, they have to allege when making the demand. The individual, one of the individuals in those enumerated
counsel, this
categories.
Is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you with a question? Doesn't 1614 make clear, as well as the Model Act, that the power of attorney can flat out say, the principal can flat out say, I don't want anybody looking at my financial information or my agency controlled data, and put a provision in there and says that. Doesn't I say that directly?
They can put a provision in for the requirement that an agent does not have to disclose when given a demand under this under these acts. However, that does not protect an agent to be able to go out and commit breaches of fiduciary duty and the like. So there's a difference between a disclosure.
That, but 1614, as you point out, was based upon Section 116 of the Model Act, and it was meant to increase the capacity for others other than the principal to have basically an equitable accounting of sorts. So it allows brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, spouses, parents, and any descendant to go to an agent and basically get information. But the principal still has a self-determination to say, I don't want that, and put it in the power of attorney. Isn't that what happened here?
Well, actually, from the Uniform Act, the Uniform Act only allowed, so the Uniform Act under 114H only allows for a mandatory disclosure to a fiduciary. They left out all those other enumerated persons. What 116 of the Model Act did was allow people to petition the court for information to review an agent's conduct and to construe a power of attorney. And that at any point in time, that principal could then file a motion to dismiss. Virginia's
okay,
General
what
Assembly modified.
What I'm getting at, though, is 1612 incorporates all the 1614 people into the ability to basically get discovery without accusing anybody of wrongdoing, unless the POA says otherwise. Doesn't this POA say otherwise?
That POA only restricts disclosure under the requisite statute. It does not. The disclosure statutes are meant to disclose actions taken. It's not actually foreign accounting. Nowhere in the statute, except for in 1621, does the term accounting appear. 1614B is actually a limited pre-litigation discovery. That's what it is. It's a pre-litigation discovery action that allows limitations on discovery permitted, which goes towards, did you have a good faith basis in your demand for disclosure? And did the agent violate that disclosure? But
is that what you're seeking to enforce, is 614B1 and 2?
No, we were seeking to enforce 1614A that says we are entitled to know and have the court review what the agent's conduct was. 1614B
Let me interrupt you again. Isn't that exactly the problem with your argument? Because 1614B was not in the Model Act. It was added by Virginia to specifically address the situation where you don't have enough information to sue the agent, and you may have the standing to sue him, but you don't have a claim yet. You don't have any allegation that there's some breach of any duty, statutory, equitable, or common law. But you can still do it unless, under 1612, the principal says, I don't want that, and puts it in the POA. So I don't know how 1614B helps you at all. It seems to me it hurts your argument terribly.
Well, 1614B, we would submit, does not apply to us. 1614B is a very limited cause of action. It is one remedy. It's one route. And all
my point is, I know I'm interrupting a lot, but you've got to come to closure with me on this. You're right. 1614B doesn't apply because 1612 says you can put a POA provision in that says the principal does not want this to happen. So the principal is his money or her money or whatever. They get to decide who looks at their stuff. So you have a very specific provision for exactly what you want to do, and the legislature won't let you do it under 1614B, and you want to construe the standing provision of A as a separate cause of action. Well, why is B there at all?
1614A is not just a standing provision. Under every other state that has adopted this act, they have all used it to construe a power of attorney and to review agents' conduct. 1614B is a carryover from Virginia's prior law that allows for a limited pre-litigation discovery, but says a determination to grant or deny in whole or in part the discovery sought hereunder shall not be considered a finding that precludes the availability of other remedies, including protection of the person or the estate of the principal. If it was meant to bar, if this section was meant to bar anybody's rights to go after an agent for any other cause of action, it would have so said that. There would have been some sort of preclusive effect.
It's not talking about barring a cause of action, because we know from 1619 and 1621 that none of the statutes meant to supersede common law or equity. You can bring whatever you got. But 1614B is talking about you don't have enough facts yet to accuse anybody of violating any statutory or equitable or common law duty, but you do need information. And 1614B says, you know what, we're going to accommodate that. But we're not going to accommodate that if that's not what the principal wants. So here we got a clause that says the principal doesn't want that. And you're saying you don't need to allege a violation of the act or of the common law or of equity. You just have a cause of action for discovery.
We're saying you have a, yes, because we are saying there's actually multiple avenues to be able to go down. When we look at how other states have incorporated this act, when we look at the fact that other states and Virginia adopted the very same language that the Uniform Power of Attorney Act had, which is to construe and to review the agent's conduct, which is different from the very narrow disclosure requirements, because there are some people that may not even fit within I. If you don't have a good faith basis that the person suffered from an incapacity, you're out, you can't review what the agent has done. It has a very far-reaching effect. Furthermore, in a case like this where the agent also occupies the executor's position, where if the executor was a neutral party, if the executor had gone to the agent, he'd be able to make the demand for disclosure to that agent. And notwithstanding the non-disclosure part of the power of attorney, that executor stands in the shoes of the principal and would never even apply to them. So you've got somebody wearing two hats and saying, you know what, we don't have to give you anything under either statute. What we're saying is A provides an alternative to be able to look beyond just the disclosure and look specifically at transactions and their conduct. For instance, someone could say, I didn't act under the power of attorney at all. I just helped mom write the checks, but she signed them. That sweeps in conduct under A. So A is not meant to be just a standing statute. That's not how it's been incorporated. In fact, even in Maryland, based on the Ebro case, this very section that they cite, they talk about it as being petition for construction of power of attorney. That's how their statute is incorporated. That's how the Uniform Power of Attorney is incorporated nationwide. Virginia has allowed a limited amount of disclosure to certain categories of people under certain circumstances, and then B further restricts it as you have to have a basis for one of these three things. Either you're going to file for guardianship, conservatorship, to terminate, suspend, or revoke an agent's authority, or for some other breach of fiduciary duty. That's it. If you don't fall into one of those three categories.
One more question. What is the best case you have? Because I've looked at your cases and I'm still struggling to see what you're saying. What's the best case that you have that says that what was Section 116 of the Model Code allows anybody on the list of 1614, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, spouses, parents, and any descendant to come into court and say, you know what, I'm not alleging any violation of anything, common law, statutes, equity, and I'm not even preparing to sue anybody. I'm not looking for information to sue anybody. I just want to see what's going on with this agent. And as any court said, oh, great, you have a cause of action under the statute to do that just because you're a niece.
Kellerman in Wisconsin said you can review the agent's conduct because you're in one of these categories, and they brought forward suspicious transactions. The complaint isn't just we have some concerns. It was there are several instances of self-dealing. There was $900,000 taken out of the joint account in 1 year. We were citing two specific instances where there were transactions and that were more than just suspicious. Maybe it was something, maybe it wasn't. But because she stands in a position where if she outright alleges breach of fiduciary duty, she may get sanctioned. But this statute has been applied in a majority of other jurisdictions as allowing people to come forward and say, I want this person's conduct reviewed to make sure they haven't breached a fiduciary duty, engaged in undue influence, provide an accounting. The power of attorney is not meant to be a shield against disclosure or against seeking information. She's not, the daughter, Miss Phillips wasn't seeking information based on a lark or she doesn't like her brother. She's not abusing that at all. She's saying, look, there's a lot of things here that have gone wrong and we don't understand where it came from. And his actions as agent should be able to be under judicial review. Certainly other fiduciaries come before the court and are reviewed all the time. Look at 64.2710. Any interested party can invoke the trust code to be able to invoke the jurisdiction into the administration of the trust. That's broad. It's not meant to be for somebody sitting in a fiduciary place of a fiduciary responsibility. It's not meant to protect the fiduciary. It's meant to protect the principal and it's meant to protect their estate. And that's what we're saying. We can't be barred.
Let me ask you this. Is under 1614, a brother, sister, niece, nephew, spouse, parent, and any descendant, they're all interested parties. They can all bring basically lawsuits to get discovery, even though they're not even making a claim of violation of any law against the fiduciary.
They can come to court and ask that a power of attorney be construed. They can bring an action to have the conduct reviewed. And that's the essence of what agents are supposed to do. The Virginia's General Assembly, had they wanted this just to be a standing provision, they wouldn't need to put in the language of construe the power of attorney. They wouldn't put in the language about reviewing the agent's conduct. They would have just said the following persons can ask for discovery pursuant to subsection B, and that's it. They know how to modify. They modified 1612H. They modified the statute in 1614. They know how to modify. And that's the whole problem
with your argument, and Justice Kelsey is bringing it out, and we're having trouble reaching a meeting of the minds on it. Ordinarily, that would be the role of a power of attorney. But this statute says, except as otherwise provided in the power of attorney, an agent shall, and then outlines what basically discovery is allowed. Except as otherwise provided in the power of attorney, not only is this issue addressed there, the power of attorney says, you don't give it to anybody, and you're my agent, and I want you to enforce my will, which is, do not give these documents to anybody. So how do you deal with that?
We deal with that under the concept that agents cannot use. So what, in essence, they're saying is, I can breach as many fiduciary duties as possible, and I can hide it from you, and I'm not required to disclose it. And Virginia law has never upheld that.
How do you handle the language in the power of attorney that says, my agents shall not disclose this? What does that do to you?
Well, the power of attorney also says that they're supposed to must use due care to act in my best interest in according with the terms of this instrument. It also is talking about compelling disclosure of information pursuant to that code section. It's not saying you're never to provide an accounting, you're never to provide disclosure of a breach of fiduciary duty. It doesn't say that. It says, under, if all things being equal, he's doing what he's supposed to do and he's not stealing, he's not embezzling money, he's not taking, yeah, I can understand why you wouldn't disclose. But in the event of a breach where they're concealing it, how can they use the power of attorney to then use it as a shield and the act as a shield? That's what 1614A is meant to remedy. That says, look, you don't have to go down this mandatory disclosure for this particular narrow purpose. Go this way, and you can construe the power of attorney and review the agent's conduct. That's what it's meant to do. It's the backstop to prevent a situation like this.
If you look at 1614A, you see various people, and I think the word standing is probably the right word to describe those people. But then B says, whether or not supplemental relief is sought in the proceeding where an agent has violated duties of disclosure imposed by 64.2.16.12, any person to whom such duties are owing may, and then there's a list of things that they may do. Well, it says, you have to look to a person to whom such duties are owing. And if you look in 1612, which that statute just asked us to look at, it says, except as otherwise provided in the power of attorney. The power of attorney says, don't do it.
The power of attorney may say, don't do that. But the problem is, you cannot use, the power of attorney also says, act in my best interest. Do these certain things. Act with, you know, in good faith.
Well,
there's other aspects
any,
to the power of attorney.
Can you have any better indication of what the gentleman who, the principal, thinks is in his good interest, his best interest? Can you get any better declaration of that than what he insisted on having in the durable power of attorney?
He certainly didn't insist upon his agents committing breaches of fiduciary duty or taking money when he wasn't supposed to. That's the whole reason behind bringing actions against an agent. It can't be used as a shield for wrongdoing and saying, aha, you can't get me, and now
but
I don't have to give you the information.
But the problem is you're not alleging, you're not accusing him of breaching his fiduciary duty. You want the benefits of all the discovery that comes if you accuse the guy of violating some statutory or equitable common law duty, but you don't want to say that because you don't have the evidence for it yet.
Because she's not in a position to have had the evidence. And based on what Your Honor is saying is she couldn't have even made the demand for disclosure because she would have been told you can't have it that way either.
Well, that's what the principal said. The principal said she can't have it, not the court.
My time has expired, but I want to answer the question. The principal was not contemplating.
Answer the question that Justice Kelsey has placed to you.
Yes. The principal is not contemplating somebody taking money and then using his power of attorney as a shield to say you can't do that. To say you can't have this information. Ha ha, I got away with it. That's not what the principal was trying to accomplish. The principal is trying to protect his own financial privacy, but not to protect somebody from breaching their fiduciary duty or from trying to conceal information that would lead to evidence of breaches of fiduciary duty. That's not what those non-disclosure provisions are intended to do. Otherwise, right. They would say, well, it doesn't matter if you discharge your duties with good faith or not. You can do whatever you want. As long as you do whatever you want, I'm going to protect you as principal.
Fair enough. Thank you for your answer.
Chief, I have a question I would like to ask.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Counsel, assuming you have an independent cause of action pursuant to 16.1614A, that would you'd be petitioning the court for it to construe a power of attorney. Couldn't the court construe that power of attorney to not require disclosure?
The court could construe it to not require disclosure, but the court could also construe it to say that the transactions entered into by the agent were in fact breaches of fiduciary duty and therefore disclosure should be made.
Right, and in construing it, the court has to decide what the fiduciary duty that is required by the agent is, correct?
Correct.
So wouldn't they have to look at the language to see what the agent was restricted from doing?
Yes. That's the whole reason for the construction of the power of attorney and the review of the conduct. That's why 1614A is not just a standing provision. It's actually to look beyond some of these things like non-disclosure provisions.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that you automatically get disclosure, right? I mean, whether you get disclosure or not is going to be based upon the interpretation of the agreement and what the agreement calls for, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Justice Goodwin, has she answered your question?
She has. Thank you.
All right. All right. Thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Scully, you have 15 minutes. The clerk will put 15 minutes on the clock.
Thank you, Chief Justice Lemons. May it please the court, my name is Robert E. Scully, Jr. I represent John Mark Raubaugh, Jr., the son of the principal under this durable power of attorney. The principal question presented on this appeal, as I understand it, is whether the legislature, in adopting Section 62.2.1614A, supplanted the entire common law of agency and rules of common law pleading in the Commonwealth and created a statutory cause of action allowing the judicial review of the conduct of every agent under every power of attorney in Virginia during the entire term of that power without any accusation of misconduct, breach of fiduciary duty, excess of authority, tortious misconduct, or breach of contract. The answer to that proposition is clearly no. There are several reasons. The most simple reason is the text of the statute itself. As Justice Kagan has said, we're all textualists now, so I suppose I should turn to the text. It says quite simply, in addition to the remedies referenced in Section 64.2.1621, the following persons may petition a court to construe a power of attorney or review the agent's conduct and grant appropriate relief. The phrasal preposition at the beginning of that clause says, we keep all of the existing common law and traditions relating to the duties of agents to principals. And in addition, we're doing the following. We're giving certain people standing to sue in a representational capacity in the event, for some reason, the principal is incapacitated. That language does not supersede the common law, and especially does not supersede the pleading requirements for stating a cause of action against an agent for breach of duty. Nowhere is that suggested in the language of the statute. The second reason that the plaintiffs claim of this new independent cause of action for omnibus review of an agent's conduct is that the code is quite clear, and the power of attorney was quite clear, as Justice Kelsey has pointed out, in saying that the duty to provide information runs only to the principal in this case. The duty to account, which is codified in Section 1612H of the Act, runs only to the principal or the principal's personal representatives or successors in interest. The duty to provide information to third parties did not exist at all at common law. Prior to the adoption of the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, the third parties identified as now having standing to bring certain judicial actions had no information rights at all. Those information rights were created and limited in Section 1612I. And as has already been noted, the prefatory prepositional phrase in that statute says, unless otherwise provided in the power of attorney. And this power of attorney makes it clear beyond question that there is no duty and the agent is directed not to provide information to any third parties. Consequently, the duty to provide information under 1612I does not exist. The statutory discovery right in 1614B depends entirely on the existence of an informational right created by Section 1612I. As already noted, that avenue is foreclosed. The cause of action that the plaintiff asserts is a cause of action for an accounting. If there was any doubt about that, the court need only look at the initial complaint in this action, which is captioned, Complaint for an Accounting. It does not assert any claims of fiduciary duty or breach of contract or any other tort or misconduct of any type. It simply seeks an accounting. It would be an odd construction of the statute indeed if Section 1614A, a procedural provision, were construed to completely preempt the substantive provision governing who gets an accounting and to whom it's due in 1612H. And yet that is precisely the construction that the plaintiff suggests, that 1614A trumps everything. If you believe the plaintiff's construction of A, there is little need for the rest of the statute at all. The court can sit in plenary review of the conduct of an agent. And that's not what this statute contemplates, and it's not a reasonable construction of the statute. The statute
Counsel, may I ask you this? So, if a brother, sister, whatever, sees a fair amount of smoke and thinks there might be fire, so isn't comfortable flat out alleging there's self-dealing, there's embezzlement, there's fraud, there's whatever. Under a scenario like this, they're really on the horns of a dilemma, right? Because
when you sign a pleading that says there is fraud, you're open yourself up to sanctions if it turns out there's a perfectly legitimate explanation for all this. So you really have to just either lump it or risk sanctions by alleging some kind of impropriety that may or may not be there. Is that the consequence of your position?
Well, it's certainly the consequence of the principal's instruction. And the keystone, the lodestar of the act is enshrining the primacy of the principal's instruction, the principal's will. That's what the statute talks about. The only unwaivable duty in the code is the unwaivable duty to act in the best interests of the principal and in good faith. Almost every other duty is waivable, and in this case, the information duties were waived. That creates a significant limitation on the ability of these third parties, other than the executors and personal representatives, who, again, were appointed by the principal to be his legal representatives after his death, who can bring these claims. Yes, that is a significant limitation. But I think there's a bit of crying wolf involved in this case, because the notion that this particular plaintiff was completely denied an understanding of the nature of her brother's running of her father's multiple businesses during the 8 years that he did so is belied by the attachments to the complaint. The two demand letters by her lawyers detail that they had gotten all of the account statements from his bank account, the Gold Elite account, all of his American Express statements, copies of all of the loan agreements loaning money to his principal corporation, First Colony Homes. The amount of information revealed in the demand letters is staggering. The notion that this plaintiff could not, in good faith, if she thought there was misconduct, have alleged common law causes of action or causes of action for breach of statutory duties, it seems a bit precious, frankly, to my way of thinking.
No, and I appreciate that, but we also have to worry about the next 1,000 cases that may not have those facts lurking in the background.
I do understand that, but I think it is a consequence of the primacy of the principal's intent and the enshrining of the principal's will. This is what he said. He entrusted to his personal representatives and legal representatives to take account of this, and note that he appointed an independent co-executor. Mr. Davies is not a potted plant in this case. He is a prominent lawyer, respected former member of the General Assembly from Madison County, Virginia, hardly a gentleman to look the other way if misconduct was afoot. Maybe if he weren't present, there would be some exceptional circumstances of the type that was claimed in the brief. But as we know, there's no factual allegation of any exceptional circumstances or any collusion or misconduct by Mr. Davies in looking the other way and allowing Mr. Rohrbaugh to loot his father's estate or to engage in misconduct in the management of his affairs. I would simply note also that the statute is, because it's in derogation of the common law, because it modifies and codifies certain provisions of the common law, our jurisprudence holds that it is to be narrowly construed. It is not to be considered as changing anything other than what is expressly changed by the statute or changed by reasonable application. And the most significant change that the plaintiff suggests in this case is that Code Section 1614A eliminates the common law pleading standards for causes of action. And it is a mystery as to how a trial judge could preside over this case without knowing what the claims are. The causes of action determine the remedies that are appropriate for the conduct. If there's no pleading of a cause of action, then how is the trial court to know what evidence is relevant, what is to be admissible, what is to be inadmissible, and what are the remedies tailored to the legal wrongs alleged and proven?
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Are you familiar, some cites have been given to us by the appellant in this case, supporting the proposition that this particular section 116 of the Model Act and various other states have been interpreted to permit any sort of accounting-like procedure under what we have as 1614A for anybody without a prima facie showing of any kind of statutory common law or equitable default. Is that your reading of these cases, and if not, why?
It is clearly not my reading of the cases. I devoted probably more attention than was warranted to them in the opposition brief, but the most of the cases that were cited really dealt with an issue of whether standing persists after the death of the principal in courts that have a split between equity courts and probate courts. None of them ever reached or addressed the issue of what the standard is for stating a claim. Most of them just passed by those objections. The Ibru case, that objection was made, but it was never addressed in the trial court, and it was not addressed by the Maryland Court of Appeals. It was remanded, and there's no decided case on remand as to what happened to that objection. The closest indication we have is the Steinberg versus Mayer case from last summer, in which the Intermediate Court of Appeals in Maryland dismissed on summary judgment, not on the pleadings, but dismissed on summary judgment a claim of this type, specifically saying there was no allegation of a breach of fiduciary duty or other actionable misconduct against the agent, and therefore there was no basis for the claim, clearly suggesting that in Maryland, at least, this notion of an omnibus cause of action for the review of conduct of agents without accusations of causes of action simply does not exist. None of the other cases cited, if you read them, all of the pleadings in the underlying cases actually alleged common law causes of action or breaches of particularly enumerated statutory duties. There's not one that has this kind of a what I call an omnibus, give me an accounting and review all of the agent's conduct without any accusation of misconduct. I would like to simply note also that I think the idea that the construction of a power is a power or a justiciable issue that remains after death is simply not in consonance with this court's declaratory judgment jurisprudence. There's no change in the justiciability of disputes implied by Section 1614A. The power ended, and Mr. Rohrbaugh Jr.'s rights to act as an agent ended when his father died in 2016. To construe the power now would have no preventive power. It would accomplish nothing. Any injury that has occurred has occurred. Any misconduct that happened has happened. And to suggest that the law is different as to the justiciability of disputes under the construction of a power of attorney is different than the construction of any other testamentary instrument under the Declaratory Judgment Act seems to be creating an exception where none is necessary. Finally, the notion of the Common Fund for Attorney's Fees rule being amended in this case seems to be a bad vehicle to do so. The legislature has specifically amended the statute to provide a statutory attorney's fees remedy requiring a pre-pleading and proof of a breach of fiduciary duty. That seems to suggest to me that an amendment to the common law rules regarding common funds should not be accomplished in this case. And finally, 801.31, I think there's no breach of fiduciary. There's no claim for statutory accounting because there's no fiduciary duty between the parties. I see my time
has
ended.
All right, Mr. Scully, thank you very much. Mr. Boland, you have 5 minutes.
Sir, you're muted.
My apologies. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm John Boland, representing the executives of the estate of Mr. Rohrbaugh Sr. While this case is primarily a dispute between the beneficiaries of Mr. Rohrbaugh's children, Mark Rohrbaugh and Susan Phillips, she also sued the estate, and therefore the estate is involved with virtually all the aspects of the issues in this case. In count one, she seeks a payment of legal fees under the common fund doctrine. But to get to that, she has to establish that, in fact, she has stated a cause of action against the agent. And therefore, all the issues relating to the discussion of these statutes that we've been going into at this point apply equally to the estate. The estate has made its arguments and effectively agrees with the analysis of Mark Rohrbaugh individually in that regard. I don't want to repeat all of that except to note in one particular fashion. If you look at 1612I, which is the disclosure statute, which also includes provisions for, in the case of a decedent, establishes certain time limits. One is the time limit for 1 year for bringing the demand, and the second time limit is a five-year look-back rule in regard to the disclosure provisions, even if they apply. That's a clear on-demand kind of statute that we have. Ms. Phillips asserts that 1614A is likewise an on-demand statute, but it clearly is not. And in fact, under her interpretation, which would allow an unlimited review of any and every action of an agent over the course of the agency, essentially it eviscerates 1612I. If there's an ability to get everything you want under 1614A, why would any party go to the trouble of making demands, potentially seeking discovery under 1614B? It just makes no sense. So effectively, under her interpretation of the statute, you have the very absurd result. Under one statute, 1612A, there's a right to provide non-disclosure, as Mr. Rohrbaugh did. But under 1614A, a party who seeks disclosure can get everything that they want through discovery. And apparently there's unlimited discovery on any matter related to the agent's conduct. And so therefore, you have this basic violation of statutory interpretation that an offered interpretation that leads to an absurd result should be a rejected interpretation. And we suggest that in fact is the case. The other count is count two, which seeks an equitable accounting from the executors. Again, that is asserted by Ms. Phillips as being a standalone on-demand statute, but clearly it is not. It provides for an equitable accounting, and an equitable accounting has to be justified for proper cause, and she has not asserted that. In fact, she asserts that she doesn't have to assert a violation of any duty to get to that state. So we have the same parallel issue here in both statutes, that Ms. Phillips asserts that she has no obligation to do anything other than to assert her status, and therefore she has the right to demand this kind of a court intervention to satisfy her curiosity over her father's affairs. Interestingly, in regard to the count two, we also have the situation where we have an estate which is subject to the ongoing courts and judicial statutory arrangement for supervision of estates by the courts under the Office of the Commissioner of Accounts. Ms. Murphy mentioned in regard to other states' interpretation of comparable language as, for example, providing for judicial supervision of trust. Well, that's exactly what we have in Virginia as to estates. The court supervises trusts on an ongoing estates on an ongoing basis based upon the Commissioner of Accounts office. And in fact, there's been no allegation, missing from the allegations at all in the amended complaint or the original complaint, is any allegation at all that the accountings have not been filed or that they're in any fashion wanting. The original complaint was filed in January of 2018. The amended complaint was filed in December of 2019, almost 2 years later. And yet there is no allegation that the accountings have not been filed, that there's anything wrong with the accountings. And so there is a basis under the court's ongoing regular order for administering estates for Ms. Phillips to raise issues with the commissioner if she believes that they're appropriate to do so, and she has not done so.
Mr. Copeland, your time has now expired. The clerk will call the next case.
Thank you, Your Honor.